your weekly fix on finance and investing. This is the Cortland Economics Report.
Oh, welcome back. Continuing on with the first hour of the weekend edition of the KE Report. I hope everybody enjoyed that first segment with Mark Chandler discussing some of the data points that we saw this week and also looking ahead to what is in store for us next week at that Fed meeting. I'm happy to say in the second segment, I am chatting with Jesse Felder, founder of the Felder Report. And Jesse, we will get into actually some of the nuances and market drivers behind the precious metals. But first, I want to recap a posting that you made to your subscribers recently discussing the risk and reward in equities, mostly focused on U.S. equities. Now, we talk a lot about the overvaluations of a lot of these stocks and on a number of different metrics that you look at it, but you're taking a longer term view of just how difficult it very well could be for the U.S. markets and U.S. equities in general to provide the type of rewards they have over the last 9-10 years. Can you please dive into this for us?
Sure. Yeah. One of the these are really kind of longer term dynamics, but one of the indicators that I started watching several years ago was something I call the Buffett yardstick. It's essentially the total value of the stock market relative to the total size of the economies, or market cap to gross national product, as Warren Buffett wrote about it in 2001 for Fortune magazine. He called it probably the best single measure of where valuations stand at any given moment. And the reason why they're such a good measure is because they have a very high negative correlation to forward 10-year returns in the stock market. So Warren Buffett has also famously said the price you pay determines your rate of return. You pay a high price, you get a low rate of return, and vice versa. And according to Buffett's measure, investors are paying one of the highest prices for stocks in history. And specifically, when you turn the Buffett yardstick into a forecast, it suggests that investors over the next 10 years should get roughly 0% return, including dividends, over the next 10 years, which is, obviously not a very good potential return for the risk you're taking. And then you can try to figure out how much risk am I taking in order to generate that 0%. I like to look at margin debt. Buffett has also famously said, be greedy when others are fearful, fearful when others are greedy. And so then the trick is, how do I determine if investors are greedy or fearful? So in his book, The Great Crash, 1929, John Kenneth Galbraith wrote, even the most circumspect friend of the market would concede the volume of broker's loans, the loans collateraled by securities purchased on margin, is a good index of the volume of speculation. So the amount of money being borrowed to speculate in the stock market is a good indicator of whether investors are being greedy or fearful. And when you normalize this to the size of the economy, just like we did with equities in the Buffett yardstick, you do margin debt to GDP, you can see over the last year or two, we've recently hit new highs, higher than the peak that we saw at the dot-com mania or the peak we saw before the financial crisis. And so those last two peaks, the time margin debt got so extreme, we saw 50% drawdowns in the stock market. And I think today when you look at this at an even greater high, it's not unreasonable to expect that the potential drawdown in the next bear market could be more than 50%, could push, 60-65%. And so when you put these two things together and you put the potential reward of, 0% in stocks and then your potential risk of trying to capture that zero, you're taking on 50-60% potential downside over the next 3 years is really the way I look at it in that margin debt framework. That is one of the worst probably risk reward equations that we've ever seen in the stock market right now.
Jesse, how much do you think of this general overvaluation of stocks, which then leads, as you said, to lower expected potential rewards moving forward? How much of this is predicated just on these tech stocks that still have a lot of money going into them, and really some of these new stocks that are coming out that just blow away expectations in terms of how far and how fast they can run right away?
That's a great question, because for those of us who lived and traded through the dot-com mania, I remember distinctly, I had I had a wonderful time investing in 2000, 2001, 2002 during the dot-com bust, because in that 1998, 99 timeframe, 2000, there were so many stocks and sectors that were left for dead. One of the best trades that I ever made was buying Ball Corp, a simple glass jar aluminum can maker, in 1999, 2000, because nobody wanted to own these old economy bricks and mortar companies. You had great opportunities. Today in the stock market, the overvaluation is not just confined to one sector or a couple of sectors like it was back then. It was, you know, really just internet stocks and telecom and some other things. Today, when you look at the overvaluation, I look at it as a sector by sector basis, and you see utilities trading at their highest valuations in history. You see consumer discretionary highest valuation in history for the sector. And so the overvaluation today is much, much broader than it was back then. The market has seen, you know, all ships rise to extreme valuations this time.
Really speaks to this overall concept of the everything bubble, doesn't it?
Absolutely. And, you know, and that's, it's not just equities, you know, the everything bubble I've been, you know, writing about for a few years. It's equities, it's bonds. You look at, you know, bonds are extremely highly valued, negative interest rates, that you couldn't get a more higher valuation in bonds than a negative interest rate. And corporate debt has surged to new all-time highs relative to the size of the economy. Also, real estate is also, it's the first time in history we've seen all three of these asset classes trade at their highest valuations in history at the same time. In the past, we've had these kind of rolling bubbles where it was equities in the dot-com mania, it was real estate during the housing bubble. Maybe it was bonds, you know, back during the Great Depression when interest rates got as low as they are today. But today, it's all three of these asset classes trading at their highest valuations in history.
So whenever we talk about bubbles and these over-leveraged or high valuations, to me, it makes me think of when a pullback or a crash does happen, this term destruction of capital, where all this money gets lost. And yes, it gets rotated into other sectors, but especially when you deal with either debt reclassifications or what have you, there is a general, again, destruction of capital. Do you see this as a potential when we do have this everything bubble? Where does that destruction come from?
Well, I think there's a lot. There have been a lot of warnings, and you know, it's very interesting to me because there are some similar parallels between today and the time leading up to the financial crisis. You know, debt is in different places, and it's been enabled by different. It wasn't, you know, the banks kind of helped enable the housing bubble. It's been the shadow banking that's really kind of enabled this the debt bubble that we're seeing today. You know, this debt bubble in corporate credit. A lot of people have been warning about, you know, leveraged lending and all these things. And I really do think that's an issue. People say, well, you know, there's no prospect of rising defaults on the horizon. Well, that's because they've gotten rid of all of the, things written into the loans, the contingencies that would trigger a default. So defaults are not going to happen when those have been essentially written out of the debt covenants. I do think we're going to see defaults on a scale like we've probably never seen before. I've also written, I think we're headed for another Minsky moment. He talks about the credit cycle in three different stages, the third stage being the Ponzi stage, where lenders are making loans not on assets or not on income, but they're essentially making loans that they know can't even be sustained by income and have to be refinanced with new debt down the road. And so this Ponzi stage of the credit market this time has been greater than anything we've seen before. The number of companies that cannot afford to service their debt out of income is a higher percentage than it's ever been in the S&P 1500 or Russell 3000, however you want to look at it. There's just tons of zombie companies out there already during an economic expansion. And so as soon as, you know, credit starts to be reined in, and usually it's the Fed hiking cycle that is the catalyst for that, there's going to be a rising number of defaults. And that, I think that's where the trouble's going to be. And you know, back in during the housing bubble, people said, you know, they were just kind of caught off guard by the bust. No, there were plenty of people warning that there was a problem coming down the pike, just as there are plenty of people warning today that there's a problem brewing in corporate credit.
Very true. But to your point, there's usually when we're in a hiking cycle, rate hiking cycle, that's when all this debt becomes unserviceable. We now have the Fed expected to cut rates 2 times this year, at least if you look at what's going on in the markets and how they're pricing in interest rates. Does that change things? Can the Fed prolong this by almost getting in front of it and starting to cut?
When you see the first cut in the cycle, you see the Fed switch from hiking to cutting. The first cut is usually not a good sign for risk assets. It's usually kind of the sign that, okay, we have now entered a bear market. If you look at the history of, you know, stocks after a first rate cut, spreads after a first rate cut, all of these things. The Fed is, even the Fed, I read a terrific piece about it today. The Fed has very, very little to do with the credit cycle anymore, and especially during this cycle. So with the rise of shadow lending, the Fed, you know, adding assets or pulling assets from the banking system, by shifting the Fed funds rate, has essentially nothing to do with shadow banking. So shadow banking operates on its own platform, completely independent from the Fed. And so, to the extent that shadow banking has grown in the economy, the Fed has become more and more impotent to do anything about it. So, whether it's rate hikes or rate cuts, the Fed, is trying to affect the banking system. And the banking system is not responsible for what's been happening in corporate credit. It's actually been shadow banking. So I really don't think the Fed has any ability to affect what's going on in terms of the credit cycle, the larger credit cycle, because shadow banking has taken over to such a great degree.
Okay. Very interesting comments there, Jesse. Let's switch it over now to the precious metals, gold in particular. If you want the bullish argument, then you can say gold is testing out this higher limit that has been stopped out on for a number of years now. The bearish side can say, you know what, we still haven't gotten that breakout, and I've seen this so many times that it's not going to happen. What are your thoughts on gold, first and foremost?
You know, I'm very, very bullish on gold. I think there's a lot of things going for it right now. I think that technically it looks really good. I think this bull flag that we've seen over the past, 4 or 5 months, gold broke to the upside above that upper, trend line on that flag. And that breakout projects a target of almost, 1450-ish, something like that, on the gold price. And if that comes to fruition, then that means gold's going to break above this 1350, 60, 70 area. And that is a much bigger bullish bottoming pattern that dates back to early 2013. If gold prices break above this 1350, 60, 70 area, maybe it's 1400 is, what some people are looking for. Then it projects a target up to, 1700. And these are just pure technicals. It was really interesting to me. I wrote about this last week, and this morning, Paul Tudor Jones was on Bloomberg talking about it, saying that he thinks gold is his favorite trade over the next 12, 24 months. A break above 1400 means 1700 in a heartbeat is going to, we'll see in the gold price. What I think is the catalyst for all of this is I really do think we've already kind of entered a stagflationary environment, and the tariffs only exacerbate that, right? So the tariffs are essentially act as a break on global trade, which is not good for global growth. It puts a slowdown on growth, essentially, but also at the same time raises prices and raises inflationary pressure. So you have at the same time, a lot of people think that growth and inflation always has to be positively correlated, and that's just not the case. You look back historically, you can have slowing growth and rising inflation. That's stagflation. And I think something Alan Greenspan has actually been talking about for 3-4 years now is that we're headed into stagflation. I think we've probably already entered into it, and that is probably the most bullish environment for gold prices, because what you have then is interest rates that want to stay lower, generally speaking, because of slowing growth. But you have rising inflation. So you have rapidly falling real interest rates, which is probably the number one catalyst for gold prices. And so I think this dynamic of falling real yields is really, really constructive for rising gold prices going forward.
So what kind of inflation data do you look at, Jesse? Because just this week, we got the CPI, we got the PPI, and none of those are screaming higher. They're actually quite close to that target 2% rate. But I know these numbers are very much massaged. They're not a true gauge of inflation. Where do you look for inflation?
Well, you know, I look at all of those things. I think you look at sticky CPI is one to look at. I think the underlying inflation gauge from the New York Fed is another one to look at. And then core CPI also, and they're all over 2% right now. So the Fed is saying we are desperate to get inflation over 2, but all of these indicators are all suggesting inflation's already over 2. And the Fed is meeting, next week to set interest rate policy, potentially make a change. I don't think they will. But one of the things they've been talking about is changing their, policy to try and create more inflation, or at least create more inflation expectations. And so I think this is also another very important thing to pay attention to. Because if the Fed is successful at this, and I do think there's a real potential that Jay Powell could become the anti-Paul Volcker. Paul Volcker essentially had to go to extraordinary lengths to rein in inflation. And Jay Powell essentially said the exact opposite of what you can imagine Volcker saying, which is low inflation is one of the greatest challenges of our time. And so you can see Volcker and the Fed potentially going to extraordinary lengths to try and stimulate inflation. And they have plenty of tools to do that if they so choose. And one of those is allowing inflation to run hot, and I think, I can't remember another Fed head said recently that allowing the tariffs to raise prices and push prices higher, and allowing inflation to run hot as a result of that is something the Fed would consider right now. We're at 2.25% to 2.5%. But they could potentially lower interest rates in that amid those rising inflationary pressures would definitely go a long way towards ramping up those expectations of inflation, which are one of the main drivers. Paul Volcker's written about this too, where he said as soon as people start expecting higher inflation, it sort of is the catalyst for higher inflation itself, because people start buying more ahead of time rather than expecting lower prices tomorrow. They expect higher prices, so I'm going to buy today. And that creates its own price pressure, and it's kind of a self-fulfilling prophecy. So I think all these things are really important to pay attention to, but they're all potentially very bullish for the gold price.
Yeah, very true. And I think some of those comments from the Fed stating that they're okay with letting inflation run and almost averaging out from those years when inflation was around 1%, they're okay with. And that's a pretty dramatic comment from a central bank. Let's also talk about the U.S. dollar, because the U.S. dollar has been moving higher for the last almost year and a half now. However, it does look like it's running out of a little bit of momentum, at least just on the charts. But then you're stuck with balancing out, look at weakness in Europe, look at weakness around the world. So why should the dollar fall dramatically? Where do you stand on that dollar comment?
I think, the main driver of the dollar is, fiscal policy. If you look at, the dollar was really strong from 2014, that 2012 to 2017 period. And what did that correspond to? Well, that corresponded to fiscal deficits narrowing dramatically and the U.S. budget improving dramatically during that time period. Dollar peaked in 2017, and that's when the market started discounting these Trump tax cuts and the widening of the deficit again. I think the dollar, has rallied over the past, I don't know, what is it? Yeah, about 18 months, not quite, 15 months or so. To me, it's a classic counter trend rally. I do think that the peak for the dollar was 2017. And the reason I think that is this main driver, the main fundamental driver of the dollar is the fiscal deficit. It's widening this year. It's going to be over $1 trillion this year. It's running at that rate already. The government has no plans to rein in spending or raise taxes. And so it's only going to continue widening. You look at, there's one thing there's bipartisan support for right now, and it's the concepts. It might not be modern monetary theory, but the concepts behind it have bipartisan support. We don't need, interest rates are so low, we don't need to worry about raising revenue. And we can actually borrow a ton. We have a plenty of room to borrow and spend. So these dynamics are what the dollar is going to start discounting. At some point, also, the Fed, you know, realized we're not going to be able to continue quantitative tightening without really hurting the bond market. And so they're going to quit that in September. And so essentially, you have a government running over $1 trillion deficit, 5.5% of, you know, GDP or something, I think we're running at, and a Fed that's going to have to be monetizing that, which is MMT. And so the dollar is going to have to start discounting those dynamics. And when it does, it's going to be, you know, another major, you know, bear market move for the dollar lower.
All right, Jesse, it's always great having you on the show. And just one other comment. A lot of what we talked about here are sometimes longer developing themes, but they've been in development now for a number of years. So all this stuff could start happening pretty soon. That first conversation regarding where the market's set up and that risk reward, very important to understand when you look at how money has been flowing and the change, how dramatically it could be, just even if a little money is diverted from simply those risk on U.S. assets. Jesse, it's great having you on the show. Thank you for all the time you spend with us, and I hope you have a great weekend.
You too, Corey. Thanks for having me on. Appreciate it.
To find out more about today's guests, visit us on the web at www.kereport.com. You're listening to the Corlin Economics Report. We'll be back in a moment.